If you would like to follow along, I'm going to be reading from Philippians, the first chapter, starting there at verse 12. Paul's writing to his really good friends, this church that got started about 20 years before this letter was written, in the city of Philippi, and that's today in northern Greece. He's writing from what most people think is a Roman jail cell, and he's in chains, and he's joyful. Hear the word of God. I want you to know, beloved, that what has happened to me has actually helped to spread the gospel. So that it has become known throughout the whole imperial guard and to everyone else that my imprisonment is for Christ. And most of the brothers and sisters, having been made confident in the Lord by my imprisonment, dared to speak a word with greater boldness and without fear. Some proclaim Christ from envy and rivalry, but others from goodwill. These proclaim Christ out of love, knowing that I have been put out here for the defense of the gospel. The others proclaim Christ out of selfish ambition, not sincerely, but intending to increase my suffering in my imprisonment. What does it matter? Just this, that Christ is proclaimed in every way, whether out of false motives or true, and in that I rejoice. Yes, and I will continue to rejoice, for I know that through your prayers and the help of the Spirit of Jesus Christ, this will turn out for my deliverance. It is my eager expectation and hope that I will not be put to shame in any way, but that by my speaking with all boldness, Christ will be exalted now and always in my body, whether by life or by death. For to me, living is Christ and dying is gain. If I am to live in the flesh, that means fruitful labor for me, and I do not know which I prefer. I am hard-pressed between the two. My desire is to part and be with Christ, for that is far better. But to remain in the flesh is more necessary for you, since I am confident of this. I know that I will remain and continue with you for your progress and joy and faith, so that I may share abundantly in your boasting in Christ Jesus when I come to you again. Yeah, I think you just witnessed a transition. I need a bigger font. Who writes these so small words in this thing? When we first got these Bibles and the other ones, the other one was like the big print one. I was like, what do you need a bigger print? You're good. Hello. So one of the phrases that I have enjoyed that has crept into our culture recently is the phrase, first world problems. And it's used in conversation when somebody recognizes that they themselves or somebody else is complaining about the wrong things. A crazy but really cool thing happened to me this week. I thought, I should just think of an example of what that is. Then I thought, but I bet I'll overhear one before Sunday. And so yesterday, I'm sitting at Dell and Boss Subaru in the waiting area, me and one other person who is speaking very loudly into their cell phone and giving me the perfect example. just her and I, and speaking so loud that I couldn't help but hear, complaining, as a young woman, complaining to her mother about what a terrible idea it was to go to Park City, Utah, for her birthday trip. Okay. She said, and I quote, "It's so cold there, and I don't want to go to the spa with a bunch of Mormons." And wow. I'm hearing this. I'm right here, you know. And I almost wanted to say, yeah, thanks for giving me the example of what precisely what a first world problem is. It's a poor you kind of phrase that we use, and it's a great phrase because it playfully points out that we are operating at a very low level of existence at that point. We're derailed because something very small has taken over our life somehow, and something that we really shouldn't be complaining about. What we're seeing here in this is the first section of the body of Paul's letter to the church in Philippi, and what we're seeing in Paul is the precise opposite. He's going the entire other way. It's not that he's just modeling that small things don't derail him. It's that what in seem like really the worst circumstances, he's flourishing. What is supposed to be derailing him is actually contributing to how wonderful his life is. He's proclaiming his joy while he's literally in chains. He's literally in chains. And, you know, in all cultures, primitive and advanced, throughout history, there's a baseline understanding. Life is simple. Try to avoid bad situations because they're what makes your life bad. Try to get yourself into good situations because that's what makes your life good. You see this most demonstratively as the religious leadership is standing at the foot of the cross and saying to Jesus, hey, if you're God, get off the cross. That's a bad situation. Get out of it. Everybody knows that you're trying to avoid bad situations because that's what makes your life bad. And this is what Paul, now his follower, is proclaiming along with the life of Jesus, that there is an entirely different way to live life. Jesus calls it his kingdom, and Paul is following after Jesus and showing the rest of the world in his church in Philippi first that there is indeed more to be seen than what they are seeing. Jesus demonstrated it. Paul is living it. And it's what is on display and is modeling for the people in both what he's saying and how he's living. You can feel his playful joy where he is. Yeah, I am in jail, and it sure looks like we're losing on the outside, but Paul needs to show them there's way more than most humans naturally see in life. What we naturally see is bad situations, and we're trying to avoid them. Good situations, we're trying to put ourselves into them. That's what we naturally think. But what Paul is showing people here is that everything that's needed is already here. He's in jail. He's wearing chains and he's rejoicing. He doesn't need his situation to change. He doesn't need something different to come his way. He's in the middle of everything that he needs right here. You know, Paul spent the first part of his life trying to forcibly change people and control the situation that was around him and make it go the way he thought it needed to go. He tried to stomp out the movement, right? These people are modeling their lives after Jesus Christ. They're living in the Spirit of God, and they're claiming that he was God here among us. And Paul was saying, you know, I need to change that circumstance. I need to make other people live how I think they need to live. But what he's living here now, he was thinking, if I change these circumstances, then I'll be okay. What he's living now is the exact opposite. What we see in him, he was trying to change situations, but now he's in the worst of situations, and he's saying he's radically okay. He's even thriving. He has discovered that everything that's needed is here. I know your brain is resisting that thought right now. No, it's not. What about X, Y, and Z? Our brains are trained. We have trained our brains to resist the thought that God is everything we need and God is right here. We buy into the old theory about human living, that what we need is change in our circumstances, that we need something different than what is right here in front of us. And this is not a resignation to life circumstances that we don't fight for change. Ironically, nobody changed Europe and the Mediterranean world more than Paul, because he was changed. He was something different. He was a transformed person, and he altered the course of European history, Mediterranean world, from a prison cell. He did not need to be a free man as the world looks at free. Here, Paul's experience, and he's modeling this truth. Everything that we need is here. And that's why he can be so radically different in the conditions that he is in. Paul is living the truth. God, nothing is more damaging to our faith than this. God is not out there, up there, over there. God is right here. God is right here. And he's able to engage that truth. He's able to embody it, to really live it, to allow it to be the lens he's seeing the life through. None of us earns God's presence. It's just here. We either engage that truth or we somehow deny it and allow our eyes to be closed to it. What we do is, the scripture uses the language, we receive it. That's what grace is. We haven't proven ourselves that we deserve it, but it's here, and so we simply engage it. It's we live in it, and then we have to ask ourselves, though, as our minds, I'm sure, are resisting, is it true that everything that's needed is here? In our bankruptcy, in our betrayals, in all of our loss, is everything that we need really here? Can we actually live how Paul is modeling for us right now? The enormously influential psychologist by the name of Carl Jung was not a fan of organized religion, but late in his life, he said that he never encountered a human problem that couldn't be solved by contact with what he called the numinous. We would call it God. In his perspective, he wasn't even a fan of religion. Any problem a human is having, it can be solved by simple contact with the numinous. Smart people always have to call God something different. They can't just say it's God. Come up with their own name. But he was saying, he was emphatically saying, of all the problems I've seen, and I've dedicated my life towards healing and health, all people really need to do is get in touch with the living God. In God's presence, we discover our radical okayness, and that life can be lived right here and right now. It's what Paul is living. Yes, I'm in chains, but look at all the good that's happening. I'm not allowing that to overtake me. More people are being exposed to this good news because of this situation. The church here in Rome is sparked. These people have a new courage. They're living differently because of all of this. Isn't it beautiful? That's where Paul is going with all this. He's able to live in an alternate and, by every standards, a better reality. It's a better way to engage life. He doesn't see God as out there. He sees God as right here. God's right here. It's Paul's experience, and so we ask ourselves, it's what Philippians is doing for me right now. Is this my experience? Is this my experience? You know, that what is here is good, as friendly, as on our side. It was late in Albert Einstein's life when he was being interviewed and talking about the different discoveries he had made about the universe when he said, I've just started to discover the physical properties of this universe that we live in. And this is late in his life, and he said, but the question that haunts me is it friendly? Is what is on my side? Is it loving? Is it for humanity's? Paul's life is proclaiming, radically so, my friend. It's very friendly. I know this is Paul in jail. I know that you're the guard and I'm the prisoner and we're supposed to hate each other, but I've got great news for you. And I want your life to be better. And so I want to share with you what's going on. We always, though, as humans, resist the greatest of news. It's the strangest thing for who we are. But we now have the neuroscience to demonstrate it. Our brains stick to negativity. Okay, all you have to do is turn on the news to watch to see that that's true. We like the negative more than the positive, and here's why. Our brains, in the simplest way, they function to the negative like Velcro. When something negative comes our way, our brain just attaches to it automatically. But when good news comes our way, our brains act more like Teflon, hot butter and Teflon slipping around. And unless we've given it 12 to 15 or so seconds, they say, about concentrating on that good and that positive, it won't stick. It just slides right off. And so that's why it is you get 300 emails in one day, 299 of them are positive and one's negative. What do you go home thinking about? Unless we practice gratitude, unless we look for it, it's going to slip right past us. That's demonstrable now. With all of that God is here and God is enough, and all that is needed is here. With that, here's what I think makes Scripture so inspired. Paul is also modeling in this opening dialogue the other side of that truth. We get ourselves in trouble when we only focus in on one element of a given truth. Paul is also modeling the other side of this truth. God is here, and so all is well. But he's also modeling the balanced other side of that truth, that all of our grief must be engaged. If we don't take both of those truths and allow them to work in our lives, lives get ruined. I've seen people trying to put on happy faces in the most horrific of circumstances because they thought somehow they were being a good Christian. Because they thought somehow, yes, this disaster has come my way, but I'm supposed to be able to find joy here instead of being able to engage all of life for what it is. Our grief must be expressed, our pain must be felt, and we must process through it. Paul is doing all of that right here in this opening chapter, and it's what liberates humans. Yeah, I'm in chains, but I'm rejoicing. I've got all that's needed. I'm also hard-pressed. I'm really dealing with this big issue. Frankly, when I think of all of life, sometimes I just want to get out of here. He's hard-pressed, and he's wrestling through that. He's opening up his soul to these people, and he's being able to say, yeah, I'm rejoicing, I'm great, and I'm this. You know, when I think about getting out of here, it fires me up. And so in that sense, I want to die. He's hard-pressed, and he's dealing, and he's processing with what is actually there, his grief, his struggle. He's engaging it. He's not denying it. We have a terrible time with grief, of course, in our culture. I think it means somehow that we're weak or we're afraid of really digging into the emotions that are there. Paul is modeling the way forward. Engage it. Process it. And also recognize that God is here, and that is enough. You know, we often skip over that, or at least try to, that negative part that Paul is able to really dig into, and don't allow it to transform us. We simply try to escape reality and its demands. All of us were geniuses at distraction and being in different modes of escape. And I do believe, I don't normally say this, but I do believe our culture actually has it harder here, because if you can imagine, the world at one time, the only place to be was where you were. You didn't have news coming in from all over the world or travelers, and you didn't have a handheld device where you can literally be anywhere but here. You're almost always there. Anywhere but here. Here, right now, is the only place God's presence can be engaged. If we are constantly there in another conversation, in email, in another video, in another social media interaction, that's bringing us there, not here. God's presence can only be engaged in the here, in the now. It's why Paul is rejoicing while he's in jail. He's found a different way through. He's got something on to the other side of it, moved through the other side and been able to find God in the middle of his particular circumstances. Well, interestingly, what prevents this kind of transformation that we see in Paul oftentimes is simply our fear and resisting of change. Humans resist change. It's neurologically proven. We set our patterns and we get into them, and we can change, but we normally don't do it without a fight. Sometimes people think, no, I love change. Bring it on. I do stuff different every single day. Well, your change is doing the same thing every day. If you tell that to a person who likes change, they go, I'd rather die. Well, that's your change. Yeah, we all resist change. It's how our brains have come together. And it's how, it's quite simply how we lived. I heard that on the edges in medieval times when they were developing a new map, and they would write down the territories and the mountains and the rivers and whatnot that they knew, but on the edges of the maps, the places that they didn't know that would bring about change and something new, it was often penciled in on the edge of the map. Here be dragons. We fear what we don't know. And it sounds so ironic, but there's something resisting in all of us about thinking, could I really be that person? Could I actually have the kind of life that Paul is living? There's something in us that immediately just tells us, no, not you. Maybe it's available for somebody else, but somehow we resist, and usually that's just the fear of actually being that blessed, of having a God who is that for you and is that powerful that could actually transform your life. You know, when we think about actual steps in order to get there, we have to look first at the whole idea of prayer, which is how Paul is teaching his body and is how he's living it for them. Bring everything to God, he says later on in this book. Pray without ceasing, he says. He can say those things because he understands prayer is far more than a simple monologue to God with a laundry list of things we're sorry for that we want. Prayer for Paul is a posture. That's why you can do it all the time, without ceasing. Prayer for Paul is an attitude. It's a stance as much as it is words. It is words, of course, but it's more of a posture, and he's living in prayer as he writes these words, as it's oozing out all over the place. Because our world, it does not naturally see the good news. It must be taught to see. It must see it in others. It's why Jesus is so often telling people to be watchful, to stay alert for all of us. And it's neurological. For all of us, life has a way of hypnotizing us, to get us into our little motions. And we don't see what is going on all around us, what God is actually doing, how God is moving. And it's why Jesus said, if you don't enter my kingdom like a child, you don't enter it. You don't get in unless you have that child's mind, that beginner's mind, you could call it. It's a simple place of humble honesty, which is always the same thing. It's the beginner's mind that Jesus is getting at, and it's what we see active in Paul's playful style of right here. Beginners, babies, they're okay with trial and error. You've never seen a baby, have you? Like a, what are they, 13 months or so, and they start walking, and they take a step, and they wobble, and they fall down. And then they emotionally beat themselves up because they failed. Of course not. They're thrilled. They took a step. They're so happy about it. But what is it about the advanced mind? That when we try something and it doesn't work out, we beat ourselves up and quit. Christ is saying if we don't enter his kingdom like a child, we simply don't enter it. And so we have our beginner's mind. I don't know how to pray. I don't know how to love my enemy, but I tried, and I took 3 huge steps forward, and then the next week, 2 steps all the way back. But look how far I got from the other week. Whole step. It's a beginner's mind that he's training us up on. It always works out this way. Every Christmas, I think I've heard this story about a parent who's got a young child. And they say, you know, we got our kids all these fabulous toys this year. They're 4 years old. They're really expensive ones. And all afternoon, all they did was play with the cardboard box. Right? Thanks for laughing over there. I thought that was kind of funny. Francis. All they did was play with the cardboard box. To a child, everything's interesting. To a child, they don't need to be somewhere else in order to be engaging what truly is. They're having a fabulous time right there with the cardboard box. Awe is easily inspired in the life of a child. Curiosity is easily inspired, and that's what Paul is living in here as he writes these letters to the church in Philippi. And this is essentially what prayer is, continuing to revolve back to the beginner's mind. Yep, I failed. I wanted to do it this way. I didn't. And here I am again. God, here I am again. I have read this too, that some psychologists are telling us that there really is no such thing as the infant stage of life now. During those first several months, however many months that is, handful of months, a baby cannot distinguish themselves apart from their mother's gaze. Whatever that mother's gaze is telling that infant is what the infant understands who they are. There's no separation between them and their mother. They are one in essence. And whatever that mother's gaze is telling that infant that they are, that's what they are. People, that's prayer. When you can get yourself where you are before the living God, allowing God to tell you who allowing your identity to be swallowed up in what it is that the gaze of the Holy Spirit is telling you that you are. Paul is clearly living in this kind of life. His circumstances are not dictating who he is. The gaze of the living God is telling him who it is. When we sit there and we receive that, we discover it is radically good reality. What is right here is radically good. And it is for us, and it is in love with us, and it is transforming us so that we would participate with God transforming this world. So we look at Paul's life, I believe, and in our better moments, we really do dare to hope. And I pray you've even tasted that a little bit here this morning. That you would dare to hope. What if I could be like? In all the situations that my life is, I know that I've got what I need right here because God's here. In our better moments, we dare to hope that we would be genuinely content when we've missed the flight. When the vacation we're so longing for, it has to get canceled at the last minute, when the disease is going to take a lot more than we thought that it would, that we would understand and really be recognized, grounded in our being, that what is here is enough. Paul's life has this. It's not resigning to the world and its circumstances. His life changed Europe better than anyone else's. Transformed people are what transform people. Because I feel comfortable offering the answer to that question of can our life be like that using this word. In fact, your life can be like that. Our life here together can be like that. I just read the story of one of America's most influential thinkers. He's a psychologist named William James. And he was born into a very accomplished family. His father was very wealthy. He was a theologian of some sorts. And his brother was this incredible writer whose novels are still studied today. He, on the other hand, is what we would have called the failure to launch kid. He was in his late 20s, and his life was a bunch of fits and starts. He wanted to go to medical school, but then he quit. He wanted to become a painter, and that didn't work, so he quit. He decided to go on this large expedition down to the Amazon, but halfway through, he quit. And he describes then that he had hit the bottom. And before he was going to do anything rash, as he did contemplate, maybe it's better if I'm not here, he said, before I do anything rash, what I'm going to do is a 12-month experiment. I will do a 12-month, a one-year experiment where he would believe in his mind, even though he had no proof at this point, What I'm going to do is believe that I have ultimate sway over my life and its destiny, and that it can improve, and that he had free will to change it. Instead of allowing his world to tell him how it was, he was going to say, whether it's true or not, my 12-month experiment is going to, I'm going to believe that I do. And so he wrote in his diary at the beginning of those 12 months, my first act of free will shall be to believe in free will. And of course, that year, his life radically changed. He started teaching at Harvard, he met his wife, and they got married, and he went on to be one of this country's and one of the world's most influential thinkers. This was not wish fulfillment on the part of William James. He did not create his reality. Quite to the contrary, he discovered his reality. What was there? Church, you can become the person that Paul is. What's standing in the way is our belief whether it can happen or not. Whatever you're dealing with can be dealt with. All that's needed is here. Pay attention now to the litany of excuses that your mind is making up about why that's not true. Those are the lies of the enemy, and they are attempting to derail you because God has this wonderful plan for your flourishing, and the enemy wants to do everything to stop it. We're going to wrap things up a little bit differently here today. For the last 3 weeks, you were invited to put on this prayer bracelet, the rubber band, and then pray as we get this study in Philippians here off the ground. And the question that you were asked to pray about is, Lord, what are you starting in me in the beginning of this year? Or what are you starting over in me here in the beginning of this year? As Paul is moving that body from good to great, that's what we're calling this series, great meaning not supersized, but great meaning like Jesus great, which we'll get at in the second chapter, the descent. The service, if you want to be great in God's kingdom, learn how to be the servant of all. That's where true greatness is, and it's what Paul's moving his people to. I want to give us 1 minute right now. I want to give us 1 minute to kind of readdress that question. Lord, what are you starting in me in 2017, or what are you starting over in me in 2017? And now there's a distinct purpose of our good friends and our dialogue with them and our small groups. And that's not what I want to turn this environment into right now, but at the end of this minute, I do want to ask, what did you hear from God? What is God asking you to start or to start over again here in 2017? And I want to challenge you. There is power when you proclaim these things in front of other people. It's what makes the end of the retreat speech is so powerful. When we say things in front of other people, it helps it to get a little bit stickier. Let's open ourselves before the living God who is right here and ask one more time. And for a few bold ones among us, let's share what that is. Let's spend 1 minute.